It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you, it's Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. This has been a week for people quitting things. So there was the announcement that Peter Capaldi is leaving Doctor Who with this year's Christmas special. So 2017 will be the last year of the 12th Doctor. We also heard this week that Ben Affleck will not be directing the Batman movie that he was planning to write, direct, and star. He's still done a script. So far, he's still committed to act in it, but he's not going to direct. And also this week, we have Star Trek Discovery starting to shoot, but without its showrunner, Brian Fuller. So it's an odd week. And the one person I thought we could talk to about this was Bill Monroe. So let's just talk to Bill. So we've lost another doctor.
We have. And, you know, it's a shame. I really like Capaldi. And it feels like we haven't had him for any time at all.
Well, although when you add this up, we still have a season to go. The thing I noticed about this is all the modern doctors, with the exception of Eccleston, who just didn't want to be there, have done three seasons. And, you know, Tennant did three seasons, and then he did a year of specials. Matt Smith did three seasons and the 50th anniversary special. Mm-hmm. And Capaldi, we've actually had Capaldi longer than we've had Matt Smith because he took last year off. Which I was hoping was going to mean we would have at least four seasons. Like after that year, he'd want to do more than one season.
Right.
But I think all we can really expect from a modern doctor now is three seasons.
Well, you know, I think what part of it is that, the schedules have been just packed and a mess. But I think the other part of the reason why it just feels like, yeah, it may have been more time and yeah, it may be the same number of episodes, but the stories that Capaldi has had, they've been good. So a lot of them have been good stories. A lot of them have been short, but they haven't been like the epic stories and having the same big impact. I mean, we had two seasons of Capaldi dealing with Clara, and that's not the 12th Doctor story. That's the 11th Doctor story still shadowing into the first 2 years of 12.
And it's also the companion story. Clara was really more of the center.
Exactly. And even when we have, you know, the huge big reveal at the end of this last season where he not only finds Gallifrey, he comes back to it and he conquers Gallifrey. Mm-hmm. And then he just walks away from it. It was just, it felt just completely thrown away. And maybe we'll see more of this hybrid storyline and the future of that. But so much of it, I mean, that just felt a little bit squandered. Anything that could have been big and that he could have owned, he didn't really get the stories didn't really give him the opportunity to do that.
Right. And that's one of the things is people have been complaining about Moffat for years. I mean, I'm not as high on Moffat as I was 5 years ago. But I'm not one of those people that's bashing him.
Right.
I also thought the last season of Sherlock was weaker than Sherlock had been. So it might, I think it is a good time for him to step down. But so I kind of wanted to see Capaldi do 1 year with a different showrunner.
Exactly. He really needed the chance to run with that and to do something really different and really interesting. Because I mean, even as we go into this next season, it's a new companion story and it's about learning about this new companion.
Right. Although it is, I mean, we still have 14 episodes because they did confirm that there will be a Christmas special after the season, which I'm sure will turn into, you know, the big regeneration episode.
Right.
So we don't know where this is going to go. We still have a third of his episodes yet to see. So so it's definitely premature to say, okay, this was the Doctor's tenure and this is what it was about. Because, you know, it's like we finished The Two Towers and we're trying to tell people what Lord of the Rings is about.
Right.
This could be the best season ever. His first season I thought was weak,
And I loved last season. I loved last season so much that he became one of my favorite doctors.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what's going to happen. I am bummed that we missed a whole year of Doctor Who in this attempt to keep him longer, and then that didn't even happen.
Right. It feels like two seasons into Tennant and two seasons into Smith, we had already had a lot more. We'd already had a lot more, been able to get a lot closer to the Doctor. And maybe that's also just the nature of, you know, a more crotchety Doctor that is less approachable.
Yeah, and maybe it's just hindsight, because Tennant had a different companion every year. So the stories weren't always about learning who that companion was. You know, there was a lot of Rose, but then when she was switched with Martha Jones, as much as there was Martha Jones' story, we still felt the Doctor was front and center. And
right.
With Matt Smith, at this point, we had still only had Rory and Amy.
Right, right. And we had a couple of really great and bigger stories that wrapped up.
Yeah. I mean, I thought the best 12th Doctor stories were those last few episodes.
Yeah, well, he did. You know, some of the stuff that was in there was just absolutely amazing with what he did in Heaven Sent.
Heaven Sent is maybe one of my – it's certainly my favorite 12th Doctor episode. It may be one of my favorite Doctor Who episodes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just – it's – not only is it mind-bending sci-fi, which is what Doctor Who does well. And I know we talk about this every time we talk about Doctor Who, but compared to Star Trek. Star Trek is so much more grounded in its storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Not only did it have that, but it had such an emotional core
right. For
the Doctor, which you don't always get.
Right. And one of the things you saw, and it really encapsulated too, the horror element of it. And that's right. One of the things that they've really brought into the series with Capaldi is that we've had a lot more horror stories and everything from, you know, the Veil in Heaven Sent to even stories like, like The Mummy on the Orient Express or Forest of the Night. These are Sleep No More. These are horror stories rather than just sci-fi stories.
Yeah, Listen.
Listen. Yeah, that was amazing.
Yeah, and horror is such a big part of Doctor Who that sometimes gets forgotten. So yeah, I think he's great. I mean, I would always want my doctors to be around for 5 years. I feel like 5 years is a good run. You don't want a doctor around for 10 years. You know, the only one who ever lasted longer than five was Tom Baker, and I would argue that those last seasons are not great. But then again, with Tennant, I mean, I don't think that year of specials is nearly as good as any of his seasons. And by the end of time, I felt like he'd been around a little too long. Although when he came back for the 30th anniversary, he was no perfect again.
Yeah, he was. I mean, well, his specials though, they were
weird.
They were weird. They were some really amazing things. The Waters of Mars and the End of Time storylines were fantastic. Planet of the Dead was cute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the next Doctor, you know, is cute. But yeah. I mean, what he did, it
gave us the Governor. That's what the next Doctor did.
Yeah, exactly. But the Waters of Mars is just such a fantastic piece of storytelling and character for the Doctor.
Yeah, I'll give you that ending. He's getting to Capaldi notes.
Yes, he is. He really is.
It's that theme that gets brought out over. And it's not just Moffat, because those were, Moffat came in when Tennant left.
Right.
But that idea that when the Doctor's alone too long, that he starts to turn, if not evil, just cold.
Exactly. I mean, and that was reflected in the Matt Smith's story with Clara, the Christmas special.
Right. Which was supposed to be her final episode. But then decided to stay around for Capaldi.
The Christmas one before that.
Oh, the one where she's introduced. Yes.
Yeah.
So obviously that would not be her last episode.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was her second episode.
Yeah, no, I was thinking of the, what was supposed to be?
The one
no,
with Santa Claus.
Yes, and that's Capaldi.
That is Capaldi.
You're
last
right.
Last Christmas.
Yeah. The one thing I don't want to talk about, and I just want to put this out there right now, is the immediate speculation is always, well, who's going to be the next Doctor?
Of course. I was just having that conversation earlier today.
Okay. So you get into it, and I'll tell you why I won't.
Okay. Okay.
So, all right. Well, first of all, who would you want to be the next Doctor?
I think what I would want to is probably most likely of my two choices would be Rupert Grint.
Okay.
If they want to finally go ginger.
Mm-hmm.
But the one I really want to be the next Doctor would require them going female with the Doctor.
Okay.
And that would be Helena Bonham Carter.
Huh.
I think she would make an amazing Doctor with the right amount of edge, the right amount of alien detachment. I think she could really nail that.
That's interesting. I feel like that would be a tall order today because she, especially with Harry Potter, she's pushed her persona into such a great villain role that it would be very hard for her to become sympathetic again. You know, whereas, you know, in the 90s when she was young, she was an ingenue.
Mm-hmm.
That was interesting.
Well, I think that could continue in some respects what they were doing with Capaldi is a doctor with more of an edge. And right. How do you play that vulnerability? I think that would be really interesting.
Well, that's also interesting. I mean, everything's up for grabs because we're also getting a new showrunner when we get a
right.
new doctor, which is exactly how Matt Smith started.
Exactly.
But it's interesting. I was thinking about this as well, and then I'll say why I don't think I should be thinking about
sure.
this. Dana Gould posted on Facebook that he thinks Martin Freeman would be a great doctor.
He could also be a great doctor. I mean, that would be an excellent choice.
He would. And I love Martin Freeman, and I love Martin Freeman in everything. And it seems like Sherlock is done. The two of them are just do not have time for a full series, which would
right.
probably preclude Martin Freeman from becoming the Doctor. But the other thing is
and especially if they want to make a clean break from the Moffatverse and
right. Because Martin Freeman is such a big part of Moffat's other show. But the other thing about Martin Freeman is he is such a great straight man that you'd have to have a companion at like a Catherine Tate level big. In order for him to work, because not just not just Sherlock, which of course he's playing off Benedict Cumberbatch,
right?
But I mean, you go back to The Office, and he's the original Jim in The Office, and John
right.
Krasinski made a career out of trying to do Martin Freeman looks to the camera. But the problem is Martin Freeman has 75 reaction looks.
Yeah,
I think you. You cannot yeah. top Martin Freeman for reaction looks in The Hobbit when Gollum says he's going to eat him whole. He does about 12 looks before he says anything.
And that's one of the interesting things about Martin Freeman. I mean, you know, he does play such a great straight man. But was he really was Bilbo really a straight man?
Yeah, he was the voice of reason amongst the dwarves. That's a straight man. The problem with The Hobbit, of course, is that it stopped being Bilbo's story after a while, which the book doesn't do.
Right. Right.
That's
the thing about The Hobbit. The entire Hobbit series, it turned into that one lunch or dinner at Bilbo's place where all the dwarves just come in and just go nuts
and take over.
That's what the entire series was. More and more people showed up to the party and just went nuts doing stuff.
Well, have you seen the Tolkien edit?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's so good.
I've heard about it.
I've talked about it on the show before, but I was stunned by how good it was. And it was like 10 gigs. So I ended up putting it on a USB drive and then plugging it into my PlayStation so I could watch it on a television. But I fell in love with it, and it it reinforced my theory that Peter Jackson made the best adaptation of The Hobbit that anyone can make. And then he made three other movies and dumped them on top of it.
There was a heck of a lot of packing material around that.
Yeah, but everything.
It's like when you get something from Amazon and it's a box inside of another box inside of another box with the airbags inside of another box.
Yeah, basically you ordered the USB drive that I put The Hobbit onto from Amazon.
And it has to be delivered on a pallet.
And it's sitting outside your house all day because they won't fit in your mailbox. Yeah, that's what The Hobbit is. But. Everything Peter Jackson shot that was in the book, he did perfectly. Like, he wasn't overindulgent in doing those scenes. Like, he didn't make bad choices. It's just, then he went and made some crap and put it next to each scene in The Hobbit. But,
He executed required elements really, really well.
Yeah, so when this editor put it together, and it was a professional editor, so it wasn't choppy at all. Like, he stretched the music cues over transitions, and sometimes he used dialogue from a different scene to be a narration to cover things. There were, like, one or two scenes I missed because I knew they were in the book and they didn't use. But the whole movie was 4 hours, and I watched it in one sitting because I couldn't stop. It's so compelling.
And it's kind of amazing just the power of strong editing that it has in that, to be able to turn that in, and you know how a skilled editor can completely change and rewrite a movie and make something really good out of something that's really rough. And well, that was the lesson that we had to learn way back in the day.
Oh, with our horrible films that you can see on YouTube now.
Well, at least I don't think you can see the. You might still be able to see the full length version of the Zany Boys, but
no, you cannot, because I did not upload that, and nor will I.
Well,
that was a film that we made. That was we got everyone we knew, and we threw in everything but the kitchen sink, and we made a half an hour movie that once I edited it down to what worked was then a 5 minute short.
Yeah, exactly. It started with a joke. And then we just hung other jokes on top of that joke.
Which may or may not have
actually,
fit.
Instead of like starting with a story.
Yeah, well, that's there as well, yeah. But The Hobbit's kind of like that. My argument with The Hobbit was always, okay, I understand why Warner Brothers wanted three movies. But why did they want them to be 3 hours long each? You know what? 3 2-hour movies would have helped.
Yeah.
But so getting back to Martin Freeman...
Yeah,
if you made him the doctor, you would have to cast well against him.
Okay,
and you know he's going to be in Black Panther. Both he and Benedict Cumberbatch are now part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Right.
So, because if you want a career, you're part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe as an actor.
And they're part of the Star Trek universe.
Yeah. Yes. Wait, Martin Freeman isn't. Is Martin Freeman in Star Trek?
Yes, he appears in. I think it's in the third of the new movies. It's not a big part.
He's in Beyond?
I think so.
Well,
I would have to double check that. But
all right, because Cumberbatch was Khan in the worst one.
Right.
I would have to check that. Yeah, they're becoming like Christopher Lee, where they're just in every franchise. And they're both in The Hobbit, because Benedict Cumberbatch is Smaug.
You know, if Martin Freeman did end up as the Doctor... I mean, Benedict Cumberbatch would have to come back as the Master.
Right. Yeah, there is that. And there was a lot of talk about trying to do that until she became Missy. I think at some point in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Martin Freeman's character, who's just like a government liaison, needs to meet Doctor Strange.
Oh, of course.
There doesn't need to be a plot reason.
That's true.
In a perfect,
bump them together.
In a perfect world, Agent Coulson would introduce them.
Yes, although that would be in the perfect world.
Yeah, although from what we hear from Marvel, Agent Coulson is never coming back to the movies once the show started. And you're not going to get Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman to appear on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because it doesn't get the ratings to bring Samuel L. Jackson back.
Right.
Now, but
you know, again, it's a comic book world. You cannot say never with a comic book world.
You can say never with the amount of money. Well, because they keep asking Vincent D'Onofrio if he's going to appear in Spider-Man. And he's like, I'd like to.
Uh-huh.
But no one's asked him.
Right.
My other choice for the Doctor, and again, I'll say why I don't think we should choose. My other choice for the Doctor is also a woman. It's an American woman, which is why I think it will never happen.
Okay.
Because like Bond, you don't pick an American for a role. But
sure.
Did you see that video from the SAG Awards when Stranger Things won?
No.
Okay, so this has gone viral. But when Stranger Things won Best Ensemble, so the entire cast was there. And the actor, I want to say David Corey, the actor who played the cop, gave this speech. And it was this rousing speech about how, as creative personalities, they will stand up to bullies and they will fight for the rights of the disenfranchised. And they, you know, and as sci-fi actors, they are will fight monsters and evil. And the whole crowd got up on its feet, and it was obviously politically directed.
But sure.
The greatest thing in the world, and you know what? I'll say it's the greatest thing in the world this week now, is directly to his right, Winona Ryder clearly doesn't know that this speech is going to happen and makes every single face. And so there's memes on it. In fact, on my page, if you go to my personal page, I've reposted it. She makes every single expression from like, huh, to yeah, to I don't know. And I was watching kind of how loopy she was, which made me fall in love with her all over again. Because as Generation X, I'm required to.
Oh, of course. Of course.
But I thought, you know what? That's who I would want to be the Doctor. I want Winona Ryder to be the Doctor.
that is not nearly as insane as you would think.
No, she's on a comeback with Stranger Things.
She could make a very interesting Doctor.
Yeah.
That would certainly be a very interesting approach. I don't think they're not going to go American to go Winona Ryder.
No.
Actually, what I think is more likely to happen, I think just sort of in response to everything that's happening, you know, whether it's Brexit, whether it's the political situation in our own country, I think they're more likely to act. I think this is when we're most likely to get a doctor who is a person of color.
It would be nice to have a Muslim or a doctor, or at least like a British Indian type of doctor, yeah. You know who would make a great doctor? And I'm sure they wouldn't ask him, but somebody like Alexander Siddig.
Okay.
Dr. Bashir from Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
Somebody like that. But I think because he was on Star Trek for so long, I think that would take him out. He's probably about Capaldi's age now.
Yeah, he would have to be.
Yeah, I mean, Deep Space Nine is 25 years old.
Right. Yeah.
And you're old too.
Well, yeah, he's played a doctor before
in space.
Yep.
Yeah, I would like, but the reason I said up front is I don't think we should play this game is because when I look back at every doctor, it's always been somebody that American audiences has no idea exists. You know,
right.
Capaldi was a big deal because of The Thick of It, which never aired in this country. It's finally on Hulu now, and the only reason it's on Hulu now is because he's already the Doctor, and the creator of The Thick of It went on to create Veep, which is phenomenal. So now you have two reasons for American audiences to look at this thing about British Parliament. Matt Smith had done one show for the BBC that didn't really run. David Tennant did a Casanova special and has a bit part in Harry Potter. I mean,
right.
You don't get big stars to become a doctor. You make someone a big star by being the doctor. It's like saying when is Louis C.K.
Except of course for Sir John Hurt.
Right, but that was a star casting because it was only intended to be that one appearance.
Right, and although he also now establishes the precedent of Harry Potter actors going on to become the Doctor.
Well, he'd be the second because he and Tennant.
Yep.
Yeah, and again, I think we forgot to mention it last week. You're right, John Hurt passed away, and I posted it. But the thing about John Hurt that floored me was how much John Rahe did. Because, you know, I think our first memory is probably the War Doctor, because he's so good in that role. And it's recent, but of course, he's the guy the alien bursts through the chest, an alien.
Right.
He gives Harry Potter his wand. He's Hellboy's father.
Yeah, when they announced him as the War Doctor at the end of The Name of the Doctor, it was like I had no idea who he was, but I knew that name, and I knew that it was a big name. I just couldn't tell you anything he had been in up to that point. But when you jump over to his IMDb page is just sort of incredibly extensive.
Yeah, he was the voice of Aragorn in the animated Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
he's been in everything that you care about, and he had that incredible voice. And he is someone who will be sorely missed. In the back of my brain, I feel like he was in some form of Star Trek at some point. It's probably not true, but you know, like Christopher Lee or now Benedict Cumberbatch. You feel like he was in every single franchise, and he was great.
He must have been a Klingon at some point.
Yeah. I feel like he's a guy that would have been an alien, welcoming them to a scary planet.
Yeah, yes.
Welcome to my scary planet. Yeah, but Hurt was great. So I think, you know, saying Doctor Who makes you a star. It doesn't find stars. It's like saying, hey, when is Louis C.K. going to join the cast of Saturday Night Live? You know, 20 years ago, he tried.
Right.
And he ended up writing Conan. You know, now he doesn't need to. So you're not going to get somebody, as you said, with the schedules being so big. I don't think you're going to get Martin Freeman or somebody at that level to come back. Yeah. You're going to get somebody haven't heard of at all.
And while we've been talking about this, I've been doing my little bit of research here.
Yeah.
We just keep casting everybody into Star Trek. Martin Freeman was never in Star Trek. John Hurt was never in Star Trek.
Well, they should have been.
It just seems like they should have been.
Yeah, see? It seems like they should have been. Idris Elba was in Star Trek. Oh, and by the way, I'm not listening to anyone who says Idris Elba should be the Doctor, because nothing against Idris Elba. He's great, but people have been saying he should be everything for too long. They keep talking about him being James Bond. He's not going to be James Bond because you keep talking about it.
Right. Right. He seems like I don't know too much about him, but from what I've seen of him, he does not play the goofball. And the Doctor has to always have an element of being able to play the goofball.
He can be funny, but you're right. He's not goofy. He's intimidating, which is he would be a really interesting Bond. I think the longer Daniel Craig goes before making his last movie, the older Idris Elba gets.
Yeah.
but we're not Idris Elba's is doing fine. We don't need to keep, don't tell me Idris Elba would make a good Dracula.
and if he gets bored, he can just pop up in another Thor movie.
Right. Well, he popped up in Avengers 2 just to be there. That scene made no sense. That scene made the least bit of sense in that whole movie.
Right.
Until we see Thor 3, which is not out for another year.
Right, exactly.
Means it'll be like three years. You know,
that scene in Avengers 2, basically, it's the riverboat ride in Willy Wonka.
And Idris Elba is Gene Wilder.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, now
that I would want to see.
Yeah, now you can tweet me and say Idris Elba should be Willy Wonka.
Should be the next Willy Wonka.
Because, you know, they keep rebooting that one.
Exactly.
All of once. Well, speaking of people that have rebooted, one of the other people that quit something this week is Ben Affleck has said he is now not going to direct Batman. And there is some worry and rumors that he may not even be in it. Right now, he says he's still committed. He's written the script, and it's going through revisions. So if it gets made, his name will be on it. And, you know, this would be his fourth appearance as Batman because he's already made Justice League. And this was supposed to be kind of the pinnacle of him being Batman. And now, just like every other DC movie, it's falling apart.
You know, I haven't seen most of the DC movies. I haven't seen the Batman movies since the Nolan trilogy.
Right. So you haven't seen Batman versus Superman?
No, I haven't. There's enough crap in this world. I don't need to fill my head with more of it. Yeah.
I'm too much of a loyalist.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for you absolutely have to. I mean, you can't not. I mean,
for me to see Batman,
For
me to see Batman versus Superman, it's like the guy who goes and sees The Who this year.
Sure.
There's only two of them left. They're really old.
It's like when I watched the last season of CSI Miami.
Okay.
I just had to finish it. But, you know, with how DC just seems to badly manage the scripts and the direction of the movies. And, you know, where the best things about, you know, said about Suicide Squad is that, yeah, it's a decent movie.
As bad as Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, and I could see still wanting to act as Batman and just take direction for somebody else. But the director, I mean, the amount of stuff he must be just dealing with from the studios and from the DC ownership, it's got to be he doesn't need that crap in his life at this
point. That's what it is, because, you know, he just had that movie with Live by Night, which is he wrote, directed, and starred in, and, you know, it's like a film noir. It did not do well. He made it for Warner Brothers, so some people are wondering, because it bombed, maybe they don't want him to direct a big movie.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, while he was trying to promote that, everyone was asking about Batman, which makes sense because it's Batman. And also, the way DC's been going lately, they're going to double down on Batman because that always makes money.
Right.
You know, Green Lantern didn't make money. Justice League might not make money. Mm-hmm. Batman with Superman didn't make as much money as they expected.
You know, and I'll bet Ryan Reynolds took a look, or I mean, Ben Affleck took a look at what Ryan Reynolds did with Deadpool when he was left alone to make the movie he wanted to make. And he's like, you know what? They're not going to let me do that with Batman.
Right. And, you know, Ryan Reynolds was so successful as Deadpool that they are seriously talking to him about coming back as Green Lantern. Not because anyone wants to remember the Green Lantern movie, but because they already kind of have a stake in Deadpool. That, like, you know what? Like, we'll make another Justice League. You'll just be Hal again.
Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll listen to your ideas.
Yeah, maybe. And that's the thing, because I had been saying, I'm not the biggest Ben Affleck fan. I think a movie like Argo is fantastic, but I'm not following Ben Affleck. But the idea that one man was going to write, direct, and star in a Batman movie, like, it would be purely one person's vision, I found really fascinating. But could it really be one person's vision if it has to connect to this shared universe, which, frankly, isn't working? I mean, Marvel directors frequently complain that they're not given much freedom because it has to fit within the universe of these now 15 other films.
Right.
So,
and that's why, I mean, Marvel directors aren't directing Marvel movies at the peak of their career. They're directing Marvel movies while their career is really ramping up and just starting to hit its big growth.
Which is why a lot of them don't want to come back for the sequel.
Right.
Or when they do, they're really unhappy. You know, Favreau was very unhappy on Iron Man 2. Joss Whedon was depressed on Age of Ultron. You know, and we'll see. James Gunn, it seems like they've given him a little more rope because Guardians of the Galaxy was so out there. First of all, in location. So we'll see how his second movie does. We'll see if he's just as miserable as Favreau or Whedon. And, you know, the brothers are TV guys, the Russos. You know, the Russos are used to coming into somebody else's vision and knocking it out of the park. Right. You know, they're not Dan Harmon, but they did great episodes of Community. You know,
they're about the execution rather than the full-on building.
Right. And the movies they have made, you know, the Captain America movies have had different, the two Captain America movies they made, not the first one, have had very different tones that fit those stories, but they're able to adapt. And now they're the ones who are going to do like the gigantic Avengers movies where everyone in the Marvel Universe is there. And if you're Ben Affleck and you've already won an Oscar for directing a movie, maybe you don't want to listen to a committee that's telling you to make it look more like Suicide Squad.
Right.
Or more like Batman versus Superman.
And which, shoot for barely adequate.
Right. Yeah. I think the last thing Ben Affleck would want to hear is make it more like Batman versus Superman, which he was already in and didn't like.
Right.
Yeah, so they're looking at a short list of directors now, and they're rumored some of them are very good. George Miller is on that list, who directed all the Mad Max, including Fury Road. So the director of Mad Max making a Batman movie, still really interesting.
That would be really interesting. You talk about a different and look of a film.
Yeah.
You know, from just a sheer color scheme standpoint, you can't get any different.
Now, have you seen Fury Road?
No, not yet.
Oh, it's phenomenal. The only person that doesn't like it is Steven, and he's clinging to that opinion.
You know, his Mad Max rants are awesome.
I know. I think he doesn't even care anymore. It's just when people bring it up, it's just he knows he's going to make people mad.
Yeah, exactly.
So he just starts yelling at it. But yeah, I mean, the thing that's so fascinating about Fury Road is that it doesn't feel like the Mad Max movies, even though he made all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, and he made the first one in the 70s. It would be like if George Romero made the greatest zombie movie ever made next year. And people were like, yeah, his Dawn of the Dead is good, but did you see his Poop of the Dead? That's a terrible title, but the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
The zombies start pooping, and then the poop starts eating the pee. Yes. George Romero let a 3-year-old write this movie.
Yeah. what's really interesting is that as we look at all these different franchises evolve over time, and you see something like the idea of, you know, obviously the effects and just what you can do with CGI is just so much different from the 70s, but also the types of stories we're all accustomed to hearing, whether we're talking about, you know, original Mad Max in the 70s, whether we're talking about, you know, going back, you know, as far as the old original zombie movies. The appetite of the audience has changed because we've seen so much dystopian right. worlds, and so many different ways that the world ends and the darkness that gets reflected in it, is that the way you tell the story then becomes very different. You can't tell that same story from those years ago that, you know, today, no matter, even if, you know, make the movie look modern, it's gotta have to be a different movie because the audience is just in a different world.
That's what's going to be really interesting about this Blade Runner sequel. Which,
yeah,
I'm slightly disappointed by when I found out Ridley Scott was not directing. They put his name right up front, but it turns out he's producing.
Sure. But, you know, with a Blade Runner sequel, sure, that's I'm interested in that. But I mean, what is it a sequel to? There are like 35 different versions of Blade Runner from the same footage in circulation. There's more recuts of Blade Runner than there is of the Hobbit movie.
But Harrison Ford's in it again. I love how Harrison Ford comes out as this grumpy guy that doesn't want to talk about his past. And the last 10 years, he's made all of his movies from the 80s again. He's like, I don't want to talk about nothing, but go see my Indiana Jones, Han Solo, and Blade Runner movies.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm gonna make a sequel to 6 Days, 7 Nights. It's called 14 Days, 3 Weeks. And hey, she's also old.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know. I mean, the book is got its own level of frightening about it.
Yeah, it's a very different book than it is a film. But
yeah,
I in fact, when the trailer came out, we posted it. It was about a month ago. I pulled out Blade Runner, which taught me again, don't get rid of all my discs. Because yep. as much streaming as there is, and I have Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime, and I started to look at the Blu-rays on my shelf and go, well, this is outdated technology. Then I wanted to watch Blade Runner, and no one was streaming it, and the Blu-ray was out of print.
Yep.
And I was kicking myself until I saw it on the shelf and realized I hadn't sold it. So we're not there yet.
No, we're not.
And you know what? No one's streaming Star Wars.
Nope.
Yeah, I watched it again, and it is timeless, and it is unique. The odd thing about it is it's exactly like Brazil, which was made at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, those two movies just came out together and created this very dystopian future which fit with each other. And then everyone else just kept trying to do it, and nobody else did it. So to go back right. to that world is going to be very, very interesting.
Well, that's, I think, you know, as I recall, and it's been ages since I've seen either of them, but as I recall, the look and feel of Brazil was still very analog. Whereas,
So was Blade Runner
had made a much more, you know, the dystopian society was a much more digital society.
Yeah, but it's like DOS. I mean, there's big,
sure.
there's video billboards, but like all the screens are, you know, CRT and green mm-hmm. text. So it's still this retro.
True. And in that time frame too, you also have William Gibson is really starting to write more in, you know, is really creating the cyberpunk genre.
Right.
And is really starting to build out imagery in his novels that aligns more with the imagery that we see in the Blade Runner movie. So it's like not only at that time were those movies coming out, but you start to see all of this awakening and vision of what we could see in that that digital future and that computerized future that, yes, obviously has the is analogous to what the technology of the day, but we're really starting to see all of this vision surround a bunch of different cultural icons and touchstones of the time. And really it's just a couple of years, but it already seems at that point that it's the visual language is already decades beyond Tron.
Right. Yeah. And to create this visual landscape, I think that's something going back to this Ben Affleck Batman movie. That's something Tim Burton was able to do. And there's a look to those Tim Burton Batman films, which I always defend, that's mm-hmm. got a timelessness to it in the way that Batman the Animated Series has this timelessness to it, where there's modern technology, but people are running around in fedoras.
Right.
You know, and actually, Tim Burton's first Batman movie is very influenced by Brazil. There's always like pipes and beams coming through things. And
yes.
again, I think that's what Ben Affleck is watching. And Nolan's movies are they're not nearly as stylized, but the way they're cut and the way they do the storytelling. And they are heightened. You know, they seem very mm-hmm. realistic when you compare them to Tim Burton or of course, Adam West.
Right.
They seem realistic, but when you watch them again, they're stylized in their own way.
Right. It's very clear that they are of the same universe.
And it would be interesting to see what Ben Affleck could do with that, especially just having the perspective that he's that guy. Like he already had the mindset of I'm Bruce Wayne, I'm Batman. And then he's allowed to say, what does my world look like? I think that's what fascinated me more than anything else. And the rumors were the script, which may still happen, but the rumors were it was going to be an adaptation of Arkham Asylum, both the Grant Morrison graphic novel and the video game series. So the rumors were the story was going to be Batman has to go through Arkham and fight all of his villains in one film.
Okay.
And you could really go crazy visually with that.
Sure.
But if you have to adhere to lackluster films that have already been made, maybe it does get less interesting.
Right. Maybe it has to be less dependent on you know, in order to be successful, it has to be less dependent on the rest of the franchise. I think you bring up an interesting point here where we start to see, again, when we start to see that same imagery and that different storytelling pop up in the 80s, I think we're starting to see that now as well, where we start to see not only is it then the growth of video games with production on video games and revenue on video games outpacing, you know, many tentpole movies. When you start talking about combining the Arkham video game and the Arkham graphic novels and building an Arkham movie off of that, we'll really start to see an interesting evolution in interactive storytelling. And you combine that with what's happening technologically through things like the HTC Vive and the Oculus Rift, and where that those technology components are now coming together to start bringing this immersive storytelling, and even things like the more portable Samsung VR solutions, and start to look at all that coming together. We've been talking about the idea of an interactive movie for a long time, from when you could do potentially different camera positions from the remote on your DVDs. But I think now in the next 5 to 10 years, we're really getting there. We're going to start to see all of this start to come together in this, much broader, more immersive environment that takes us well beyond where we are, even with IMAX today.
Yeah. And, one of the first games that PlayStation VR launched with was the Batman Arkham game. Mm-hmm. Where you go into the Batcave, you put on the Batsuit, you get in the Batmobile. And I was gonna get the virtual reality for Christmas, but then I wasn't working, and now I am.
Oh, there you go.
So
you know what you could do in there?
Yeah.
You could get in the virtual reality and you can get a guitar in there.
Well, like a virtual, you combine that with Rocksmith. So the last thing I want to touch on before we go, this is again in the vein of people running a franchise, leaving that franchise. Very common theme this week.
Of course.
Star Trek Discovery has started shooting, but of course, Brian Fuller had stepped down to do Neil Gaiman's American Gods. And so we have the franchise relaunching without the visionary who put it together. So how are you feeling now about the new Star Trek series as a diehard Trekkie?
I think Star Trek does best when the visionary who puts it together has nothing to do with it.
Like Gene Roddenberry?
Yes.
Or Rick Berman?
Gene Roddenberry out of the picture, things got much better. I think it's, I'm optimistic. I think it's going to be good. And I am still looking forward to it. We need to understand exactly what the streaming model is going to be and where we can see it. And that has the potential to be really frustrating. But I think it's going to be good. Of course, I'm also the guy who likes both Enterprise and Voyager. So what do I know?
Yeah, you cast a wide net. That it's an interesting thing.
I have a very tolerant viewpoint on Star Trek and what is good in there. I'm still not going to defend the motion picture or that that second movie in the new universe or Nemesis, which might be the worst film ever made.
You'll defend Star Trek V though. The one they let Shatner direct.
that has got such of its own train wreck that it's really its own thing, and I'm not gonna defend it. It's not. I will say it's not as bad as Nemesis.
Yeah, we've had this debate for a long, long time about what's worse, Nemesis or Star Trek V. I think Star Trek V is worse. Because if you look at the deleted scenes for Nemesis, you could see there was a good film in there that just got cut out of its own movie. There was nothing good in Five. There's no way you could. It's like you were saying about The Hobbit. The movie's so made in the editing room. There was nothing to make in that editing room.
Star Trek Five was a much better movie than the director wanted to make. If Shatner had gotten his way with Star Trek V, it would have been even worse. That's what's so amazing about that movie, is that we talk about, DC messing up all of the DC movies because they won't let the movie creators go do what they want. And the studio is just coming in and messing with the director and just breaking everything that the director is doing. Shatner in Star Trek V is why they do that, because he wanted to make such a terrible, terrible movie. And they made it just a really, really bad movie, thanks to interference from the studio.
Yeah.
Which means that Suicide Squad and Batman versus Superman, it's Shatner's fault.
Okay. I do think it's interesting that you bring up the streaming model kind of being the make or break. I agree. The pilot is going to be shown on CBS, but then it is moving to streaming, and it's a new streaming model. And Yahoo tried that 2 years ago and killed Community by doing that. And then Other Space, which
Yahoo was drowning, saw Community as the lifeguard and pulled the lifeguard under with it.
Yeah, but they launched their streaming service with Community and tanked it. And then the other show they had, Other Space, was Paul Feig's sci-fi show with Joel Hodgson, which was great. And I only saw about four of them because I got so frustrated with Yahoo. And now I read an article where the rights have reverted to Paul Feig and he's putting it online. And they're like, now you can finally see this show that Yahoo buried with itself. So, I mean, CBS could very well bury themselves. Stream, just because they know how to run a broadcast network doesn't mean they can do streaming.
Right.
And unfortunately, Netflix has the rights for Star Trek Discovery everywhere except the U.S. because CBS doesn't have their streaming in other countries. So it's not going to hitch its wagon to a Hulu. If it was appearing on the CBS network, it would be on Hulu the next day.
Exactly.
So that's going to be interesting.
So they're putting not only CBS's ability to run a streaming service, but in so many industries, there's not room for a number four or a number five or a number six. There's room for a 1, 2, and 3.
Right.
And is there
and a CW? Do I really
want to subscribe to another streaming service? No.
No. You know what? I feel like the best thing to do is subscribe to it for that 1 month after Star Trek is finished. Binge watch it, and then you go, all right, I've paid a monthly fee to watch these 13 episodes.
or I used my first month free promo.
The greatest thing in the world.
This week.
My greatest thing in the world this week is my Star Trek communicator. This was a Christmas present from the girlfriend, and I am loving this thing. This is the original series Star Trek Bluetooth communicator. So this is the speakerphone for my cell phone now. It actually flips up like Kirk calling the Enterprise. It has the sound effects, and it just looks awesome. And you know, when I have a regular employment at some point, I am looking forward to walking around an office and just pulling out my communicator to make a phone call.
That's pretty good. I have the one Diamond put out, which is not Bluetooth enabled whatsoever, but it does have voice clips, a lot of Shatner voice clips, and I still do love that. That's awesome. You know what? Staying on Star Trek and staying with Diamond does an amazing job with the ships, the Star Trek ships in Star Trek. And the figures have come and gone over the years, but the ships have always been a big hit, and they've always just knocked it out of the park. But one of the design flaws that the ships have had has been the stands. And depending on how heavy the ship is and what kind of plastic is made, some of the stands haven't lasted. So I was just kind of going around eBay, and I found a little seller that made laser-cut acrylic custom stands for the Star Trek ships. And they've custom-made them to each ship, depending on size. So I had some PayPal saved up. I had done a lot of sales. And I had an Enterprise-D that no longer had a stand. And Diamond made a gigantic Enterprise-D. It's like a $75 ship. Uh-huh. And the saucer separates, and there's magnets. But it was too much for its own stand. So they made an acrylic laser cut stand which grips the D behind the nacelles, and since it's clear, it manages to float.
Interesting.
And since it's putting all the weight in the back, the stand stops, before the deflector dish.
Right.
So most of the ship is just suspended in space. So I had, like the D leaning on a shelf for a long time. It would go back in the box for a while, depending on display space. But I now have the D on one side, and I have the A. It's not the A. It's the Wrath of Khan ship. It's the refit. coming out the other side, because those are my two favorite Enterprises. I'm thinking about going back and getting another stand that they made for the E. Because I have an E with no stand.
Of course.
And First Contact is one of my favorite movies. So it's a ship I want to have on display. But it just reminds me of how many just cool little cottage industries there are that don't even have their own website. You know, they just have an eBay shop, and they'll custom make something amazing. And I apologize. You know what? I apologize for not knowing the name of it. I will post it.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things that's really cool that's been happening as far as things like 3D printers and laser cutting machines become so much less expensive and accessible, and the technology has made it possible, and the things that are happening in the makerspace arena are really making some incredible things happen. That really what it takes now is it just takes the idea that, hey, this would be cool to make, and you know what? You can go do it.
Yeah, there's so many things that are more possible now. We live in this odd time where the name of them is Flux Dimensions. And it's awesome. One word on eBay, and as far as I know, they have nothing else other than eBay. So if you have any of the diamond ships, I know they've made one for the Bird of Prey. They've made one for the original series. They've made one for the Bee, for the Excelsior. If Diamond has made a Star Trek ship, these guys have made a custom stand for it. So, but yeah, we're in this place where the economy is being eaten by these giants and the middle class is shrinking. But you can still, as a middle class person, just still kind of create your own industry. You might not make a living at it anymore, but you the entry has been so lowered.
Exactly.
That, you know, I tend to find if anything seems cool and tactile in the world, I look on eBay first, because somebody probably has one and is selling it. I am selling nothing, so I won't give you my eBay handle, but you can find me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the official Twitter handle of the show. You can follow the show on Facebook, facebook.com/caffeinatedcomics. And that's where we post things like trailers and the announcement of Peter Capaldi leaving and Ben Affleck leaving and John Hurt leaving us. And if you want to hear any of our episodes, if you want to hear our review of Batman versus Superman or Suicide Squad, not Blade Runner. We haven't been doing the show that long. but Mad Max Fury Road, you can hear. You can listen to every episode on iTunes, on Stitcher, or at caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com. And Bill, how can we find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at currentlybill, much easier Twitter handle than I used to use. And you can also find me on my podcast over at 2-Minute Talk Tips, a weekly podcast about becoming a more effective public speaker. And in fact, an episode I posted this week about managing the beam from your projector and credibility, I even end up going off on a donut rant inspired by The Dark Knight. So be sure to check out 2MinuteTalkTips.com or find 2-Minute Talk Tips in iTunes or in Google Play Music.
Yeah, it's a great show. You've already had me on, and I'll come back whenever you ask me.
Awesome.
And you can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the official Caffeinated Comics Twitter feed. You can also like our Facebook page, facebook.com/caffeinatedcomics. That's the main news site for the podcast. And you can listen to every episode of Caffeinated Comics on caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com. There are close to 300 episodes over the last close to 4 years. You can listen to any one of them. If you'd like to visit Steven at his shop, who's not on this show, but he usually is, you can find him at 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We'll talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that, meatball!